I'd like to talk to you on what I just simply refer to as why do God's people suffer? Why do good people suffer? The sufferings of the saints of God. In the verses in the 73rd Psalm that I asked Brother Marty to read, the first 12 verses or so of that Psalm, the writer of the Psalm, whom I am told is Asaph. Now, I understand that most of the Psalms were written by David, but according to the Jewish records, there are a few that supposedly were written by Moses and maybe a few by Asaph. The 73rd Psalm is credited to Asaph, but regardless of whoever wrote it, the writer expresses a condition or expresses a feeling or frame of mind that I have been in a number of times during my pilgrimage here on earth. He says that there was a time in his life when he was envious of the foolish, when he saw the prosperity of the wicked. That is, he begins to observe wicked, ungodly people in this world. And he says there are no bands in their death, their strength is firm. And he points out something that I have observed in the years that I've lived on earth, and you older people certainly have observed it, and if you younger people haven't, you will if you live long enough. It's quite often true in this world in which so many things seem unfair that we see very godly, very spiritual-minded people that are born into this world with weak bodies. Some of them are born into the world physically afflicted. Some are born in the world blind. Some are born in the world without hearing, maybe with one eye or no eyes. Born in the world with crippled legs and crippled bodies, they're weak from birth, and live a life of suffering. Very godly people. And on the other hand, we find people who don't seem to care any more about God than a hog does Sunday, that are born into this world with a rugged physical constitution. They make excellent athletes and outstanding soldiers, and live to be 75 or 80 years of age, live ungodly lives, and finally at the end of their days, they draw their feet up into the bed and breathe their last, and they die peacefully. And on the other hand, I stand before you tonight and witness to the fact that I have seen some godly people, some outstanding preachers of the gospel, some fine mothers and fathers in Israel, pass out of this world suffering things that I would not want to take up the time to describe in a pulpit tonight. I've seen godly women and godly men and some of my minister friends, that some of them left this world dying of cancer or racked with arthritis, that had crippling afflicted strokes, that left this world freezing to death one minute and burning up with fever the next. I mean, you could hear their teeth grinding down the hospital corridors and hear their screams of anguish, and they were shooting morphine and painkiller into them right and left, and you'd see the sweat pop out on the brow all over the face. And the next minute they'd want to be covered up because they were freezing to death. I've seen men who were once outstanding physical specimens that looked like athletes or football players in just a matter of about 4 months reduced to a skeleton. There's a dear friend of mine, a minister in Nashville, Tennessee, pastored a church that has over 300 members in it. And about 1 year ago, when I was up there preaching for them, the news came out that he had some kidney trouble and was going to be operated on, and before I left there, they revealed that they could not operate because he had cancer in both kidneys and in the liver, and it was all in the bloodstream. And here was a man who was a hunter and a fisherman and an outstanding physical specimen of a man at about 48 years of age, and in about 5 months after that, I went there to preach the final time I ever saw him, and his skin was an ash-gray-yellow color, and it looked like it had been just stretched over some bone. That man was reduced to a skeleton in a matter of about 5 months and left behind a young wife and some small children and left the church without a pastor. There's something tonight in my carnal, natural reasoning that tells me that's not right. I can think of a minister of the gospel in the state of Mississippi tonight who has been one of the most outstanding and useful ministers that our people have had in this age. Most of you younger people may have never heard of him, an old gentleman named Elder J.D. Holder. And in my boyhood days, he had as much influence in the Southwest and the Mid-South as any living man, was called on to defend our cause in debates time and time again, and was one of my fathers in the ministry. And I suppose up until I was about 30 years of age, I considered him my model preacher. And that old brother has been crippled and has been in a bed now for about 5 years. And his mind is gone. He has to be waited on just hand and foot and has no communication except in just spasmodic little moments that come from time to time. That old gentleman has laid right there and has suffered for the last 5 years, apparently cut off from the world. And if he's dying, he's dying hard and he's dying slow. But on the other hand, I could tell you about a man in my hometown that's 80 years of age that denies the virgin birth and will tell you and has told me in grocery store aisles and has told me on the sidewalk. And I've carried on many, many conversations with a man I'm thinking about tonight. And he's one of the most wicked, ungodly, atheistic people I've ever known. He's a brilliant individual. I imagine he's got an IQ of 145 or 50. At 80 years of age, he doesn't wear glasses. And he can read just about anything he picks up as fast as I can. He can read several hundred words a minute, remembers what he reads, and spends his time reading filthy magazines and things that make a mockery and spoof of religion and the Lord Jesus Christ. And he thinks preaching the gospel is a joke and that whatever your ideal in life is, that's your Jesus. And he can explain the virgin birth to you tonight in a way that would make every child of God in this building sick if you've got any principles to you. I talk to that man quite often. He's a brilliant man. And his family tells me that he has never been sick a day in his life. He never had the flu. He reads all the time. He is one of the most brilliant, intelligent people I've ever met in my life, and he knows he's brilliant and intelligent, and is one of the most God-hating, Christ-rejecting, Bible-despising people I've ever known in all the days of my existence. And you can't bring up a subject he can't discuss, or I never have. I never have. And he doesn't even wear glasses. All right? You might say, well, that sounds kind of unfair. A man who has been one of the most outstanding and useful ministers of this day and age is still living like a vegetable. Over in Corinth, Mississippi. Been there flat on his back for nearly 5 years. Now, here's somebody over here that apparently is as ungodly a person as you can find, enjoying good health, got good eyesight. And one of these days, I expect that old character out in Graham, Texas, will probably get run over by a car, or he'll just fall over and die. That's probably what will happen. And there's something within me tonight that wants to say that's unfair. I've known godly people that went through life living from hand to mouth, that all the money they had in the world was what was in their hip pocket. They struggled all the days of their lives to make ends meet. And I can tell you tonight of some ungodly characters in my country that everything they touch seems to turn into gold. All right? This man says that I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. And I know that other people have shared those thoughts because in that hymn book is an old song, you know, that we'll understand it all by and by. It says, why do we struggle while others prosper, yet living so wicked year after year? I'm not going to stand before you tonight and tell you, if you'll come down this aisle and join the old Baptist church and let one of these preachers baptize you, and if you'll read your Bible and pray to God and live a godly life, I'm not going to stand before you like, Reverend Ike up here in New York, and promise you that you'll have perfect health and live to be 75 or 80, and that you'll make a great fortune, and that your troubles will be over, and that if you'll just live right, I'm not going to tell you like Jimmy Swaggart and Reverend Ike and all of that bunch, that if you'll just live for God, that all of your troubles are over. I'm going to tell you this, that as far as the spiritual troubles of your soul are concerned, the troubles about your salvation, as far as those troubles are concerned, many times when a child of God takes up his cross and does what's right in the service of God, there are some spiritual cares and burdens and troubles that are over for you. But on the other hand, there are some other troubles for you that have just begun. I tell you one thing. When you declare war on the devil fights back. And back when I was in high school, we had boxing and phys ed. And I knew a lot of boys that were real good shadow boxers, and they could put up a real good fight in front of a mirror. But when they got out in the ring with another boy, they weren't quite so good. And the devil fights back. Anytime a child of God comes down that aisle and somebody baptizes them, they get over here in the church and they start trying to live for the Lord, you can expect to have some trouble in this world. The Lord promised his disciples, he said, in this world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. That book promises us in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 13, he says, all that will live godly in Christ shall suffer persecution. That's what he says. And I've told congregations all over America, or have tried to, that if you live for the Lord, you've got the devil after you. And if you live for the devil, you've got the Lord after you. And if you try to live for yourself, you're going to have both of them after you. And that's no choice for me. I mean, I'd rather try to live for the Lord and have the old devil after me with the Lord there to fight my battle than to risk trying to live for myself and have both of them after me. But I repeat that, if you live for the Lord, you're going to have the devil after you. You live for the devil, you'll have the Lord after you. And if you live for yourself, you're going to have both of them after you. There are many troubles for the child of God that will begin, and they will get harder, more severe, and more intense when you attempt to serve God like you ought to. I make you this challenge tonight. Now, you can go back to anywhere that I ever lived, that I was ever in school, and you won't find, I don't think you'll find a teacher or anybody I ever went to school with that say a harm word against me. I don't think you'll find anybody I ever dealt with in the piano business that would say a harm word against me. I don't think you'll find a neighbor that I've got in Graham, Texas that would say aught against me. But if I've got any enemies anywhere in the United States, it's enemies that I have tried to make from preaching the gospel. And most every God called servant would tell you that tonight. All right? Many times, my friends, true enough, when a child of God does what he or she ought to, there are some spiritual troubles that you have out there when you know your duty and responsibility and you won't do it. There's some trouble you get into that you get out of when you do what's right. But on the other hand, there's some other troubles that just began. And he says here, this man of God that wrote in the 73rd Psalm, he says, I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Well, there's been from time to time I've shared that feeling. He goes on to say, he says there's no bands in their death. Their strength is firm. He says, I see godly people die. I see them suffer. But he says, I see wicked people that, as I've said before, just draw their feet up in the bed. They draw their last breath and they pass peacefully out of this world. He says their eyes are filled with fatness. He says they have all that they could wish. And he says that I have washed my hands in vain. I cleansed my heart and innocency all the day long. In other words, he says that all of this sanctification and cleansing and the service of God that I have gone through, he says it's all in vain. He says I might as well live like they have, because they have material prosperity sometimes more so than God's children. Sometimes they have more physical health than God's children. And sometimes they die a more peaceful death than God's children. He says, I've served God in vain. But I want you to notice something. He says he was confused about that matter until I went up into the sanctuary of God. Then understood I their end. He said, I was confused about that matter until I went up to the house of God. Then I understood it. And I want to throw this experience in while I'm speaking right here. A little over a year ago, I was preaching up in the city of Nashville, Tennessee, and there was a young man, very interested in the church, that was working in a dairy for a man who was a member of another denomination of people. And this young brother kept asking that he could get off each night in order to come to the meeting. Well, the first night, well, the man agreed to it right quickly. And the second night, you know, he's a little more reluctant, but he agreed to let the boy go. The third night, he agreed, but he was irritated. And finally, the fourth night, the employer just blew his lid, and he says, I don't understand this. Says, you're a church member. You're a saved person. Says, why do you want to go to church every night? He says, I think that these gospel meetings that we hold, that they're more for the benefit of the unsaved than the saved. And says, you're saved already. Why go to church every night? And that night, when he came to church, I quoted this very scripture. And he took that right back to his employer. All right, here we're seeing a case where an individual, one of the inspired writers of the Bible, is telling his own experience. Here, a child of God, an inspired writer, if I might use the term, a born-again saved person, is writing his experience, and he says, I became confused about something until I went up to the sanctuary of God, then I understood the matter. And that ought to prove to you right there that there are benefits that come from God's children who are already born again going up to the house of God. All right? There's a major difference between Old Baptist and many of the denominational groups of this world, and I say it in all the kindness that my old horse voice will allow, is that we believe and the Bible teaches that the gospel and that these meetings are to feed and sustain the child of God. We go over here into Ephesians chapter 4, verse 8, and it says, wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Down there in verse 11, he names the gifts that he gave unto men. It says he gave some apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. The next verse tells us why he gave those gifts. He gave those gifts for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And you couldn't take a flashlight or a locomotive headlight and search that passage of Scripture and find where it hints, intimates, or implies that he gave any of those gifts for the making of children of God out of dead alien sinners. Those gifts were given for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And you might say, I don't feel like going to church tonight. I don't feel like going this morning. My children have disappointed me. My boss has given me a hard time all day. I've been in a quarrel with my wife. I've gotten a bunch of bad news here. And I'm all down in the dumps, and I just don't feel like going to the house of God. Well, you see, this man over here, that was the very time when he needed to go the worst. Sometimes people, when they get in bad shape, that's when you need to go to the house of God the worst. Like Brother Cunningham and I were discussing another morning, he gets up and runs so many miles every morning, I try to if I can. And there's some of those mornings, you know, you just get up and you just ache all over. And you think it'd be the most ridiculous thing in the world for a man that didn't get much sleep last night. You know, you toss and turn, didn't sleep but about 5 hours. And you say, well, what I need to do is just lay here and sleep about 3 or 4 more hours. But if you could ever get yourself out of the bed, the best cure for that feeling after a restless night that I know of in this world is to get out here and start getting a little blood pumping in the old body and get to breathing and get to doing stuff that looks just the opposite of what a person thinks they ought to do. Man says, I didn't sleep a lick last night, and I'd have to get feeling better to die, and I'll roll over and sleep about 3 or 4 more hours. Really, probably the best cure for that thing is to get up and get to doing something, just the opposite of what you thought. And my friends, when a church member, they get all down the dumps and beat and discouraged, and they say, I can't pray right now because it's too hard for me to pray, as I said about 2 or 3 nights ago, when it's the hardest for you to pray is when you need to pray the hardest. All right? Now, this man got in a bad fix. And he said, I went up to the house of God, I went up to God's sanctuary, and he said, then understood I their end. He said, I understood that these people, that they have their feet set in slippery places. He said, I understood that the devil's people, the wicked people, that they return hither, that regardless of what some people say up here in Brooklyn, New York, who put out these little magazines, who claim that there's no resurrection of the wicked, this text says that the wicked are going to return hither. It says they're going to be resurrected, they're going to come back, and it says the waters of a full cup are wrung out unto them. The waters of the cup of the judgment and wrath of God are going to be wrung out to the wicked. All right, the child of God will never partake of that cup because you know why? Because Jesus Christ has already partaken of it for you. When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. I never intend to drink of that cup unless I'm severely deceived because Christ has already drank it for every child of God. But he says here that the wicked are coming back. Therefore do his people return hither. They're going to rise from the dead. And he says the waters of a full cup are wrung out unto them. And he says that their feet are set in slippery places. And he goes on and says that what? That their future is what? Judgment, hell, and destruction. That's what's ahead for them. And when that child of God begins to realize these things that he was reminded of when he went up to the sanctuary of God, he says, Lord, says, thou shalt guide me with thy counsel, and afterward receive thee up to glory. You see, he went out of there happy about that matter. He said, God's going to guide me by his counsel while I live, and after that he'll receive me up to glory. He was in the wrong frame of mind. And he was troubled about the very thing that's on my mind tonight. Why is it that sometimes godly people suffer in this life? They're born hard, they live hard, they die hard, they suffer in their life, they suffer in their death, and maybe live a hand-to-mouth existence, and ungodly people are born strong, they have fullness, they have prosperity in their life, and they die a peaceful death and pass out of this world. Alright? One little warning flag and one little word of caution I want to say tonight before I get started. There's a little streak of Phariseeism and self-righteousness that runs through all of us. And it ran through the apostles, and it ran through people in Bible times, that whenever we see somebody that's being blessed with health, material prosperity, whatever, that we automatically assume that they have divine approval, like God blessing them. Now there's also a little streak of Phariseeism and self-righteousness in us, that whenever we begin to see somebody suffering, that we automatically assume that God's displeased with them and that God is punishing them. Alright? Let's go over to the 28th chapter of Acts. Back there in Acts chapter 27, you remember the Apostle Paul is at sea, and a great storm arises, and they're in danger of shipwreck. After that ship is wrecked, you know, down there in Acts chapter 28, verse 1, it says they came upon the island of Melicia, old Bible name for Malta. And it says there, the barbarians showed us no little kindness. I mean, here they come out of the water, probably wet. They suffered shipwreck. They're cold. And these barbarians are very kind to them. The barbarians build a fire. They show them a great deal of kindness. And as they're warming themselves around the fire, the Bible tells us that there was a viper, a deadly viper, comes out of the fire and fastens itself on Paul's hand. All right, listen to those folks. Look at verse 4. It says, they say, no doubt. No doubt. This man is a murderer. Whom, though he escaped the sea, yet vengeance suffereth not to live. This man over here is bound to be a murderer. He's bound to be a runaway criminal. And the reason that ship wrecked out there was because the justice and the vengeance of God was after him. That's why the ship got in trouble. And he got by the shipwreck, but now he's got it. That deadly viper has bitten him, and he's going to die. Just because they saw something bad happen to Paul, they concluded that no doubt he's a bad character, the wrong kind of an individual. But notice, Paul shakes the thing out off. He not only didn't get sick, he not only didn't die, he didn't get sick, he didn't feel any harm, his hand didn't even swell up. And the next verse says, and they changed their minds. And man, I mean they changed them in a big way. They changed their minds and decided that he was a god. Well, I call that a change of mind. Something bad happened to him, he's a criminal and a murderer. Something good happened to him, he's a god. Did you know a lot of God's people that way? I've seen gospel preachers, God's people fill up buildings to hear them, rejoice under their preaching, eat and drink spiritually under what they have to say, and then maybe later on that man would get drunk, or he'd do something that displeased them, and maybe he'd get chastised and corrected by the church and by the community, and I've heard folks say, well, that fella never did fool me, never heard him preach a lick in my life. When I knew good and well ahead, I'd seen him shed tears, get shouting happy, fall at the mouth, jump up and down over the man's preaching, couldn't anybody preach but him. But that's the way folks are. All right? You find some preacher out here, and everything's going real well for him, and all of a sudden maybe some of his children can disappoint him, maybe go to the bad, maybe people can start dying in the church faster than he's baptizing them, and maybe he'll go into a period of spiritual darkness, maybe go several months or a year, and not really have any light in his preaching, and folks will automatically start scratching their heads. You know, what's he done? You know, bound to be shirking his duty, bound to not be doing his responsibility. Why, my friends, I could tell you a lot of instances tonight of people that different things happened to them, and folks would tell me that beyond a shadow of a doubt, that's happened to so-and-so because he's... And I will tell you another thing about old Baptists, if you haven't figured it out. Just about any young man, or any old man, for that matter, among our people, that starts having a hard time of it, folks will automatically assume he's called to preach. I knew a boy not too long ago that had to be put in a mental ward for about 6 months, or 3 months. And folks took me aside, and they said, don't you believe that the cause of his trouble is that he's called to preach and fighting it? Why, that's just the way our folks are. You think a young man over here goes having a little trouble, you know, all that, he's automatically called to preach. I mean, they get ready to start ordaining. Listen, my friends, we can jump to some pretty terrible conclusions when you begin to see people suffer. And just because people suffer in this life does not automatically mean that they've done something wrong. And it doesn't automatically mean that a young man's called to preach. And on the other hand, just because somebody is blessed with material prosperity and abundant health doesn't necessarily mean that they're walking in the will of God. Because the Bible tells us about these foolish people who assume that gain is godliness. All right? Another example, I go over here in John chapter 9. John chapter 9, look at verses 1 and 2. Jesus Christ and his disciples passed a man who was blind from his birth. And in verse 2, those disciples raise a question. But look at the question. It's very revealing. They say, who hath sinned? Now, they don't say, did somebody sin? Did somebody sin to cause this? They don't say that. They assume that somebody sinned. Now, we know good and well sin caused this. Who hath sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Well, the question's a little bit ridiculous. Because a man, in order to sin, in order to be born blind, would have to have sinned before he was born. Can you see that? A little bit silly, isn't it? All right. Who hath sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They said, here's a man born blind, somebody bound to sin. Jesus Christ says, neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. He says that this blindness is not caused by his sin, it's not caused by his parents' sin, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. All right? My dear friends, we've seen some scriptural examples tonight of people who suffered, and it was not necessarily because of some particular sin that they had committed. Now, as far as the scriptures are concerned, there can be a difference between punishment and chastisement. And I say to you tonight that there are times, and I fully realize that the scriptures teach that there are times when people are chastised and they're afflicted, and those chastisements and afflictions are sent from God. They certainly are. But let me say this. That whenever God chastises his children and teaches them a lesson, you know what it's for. And you know what it's about. Because God's a far better father than I am. But no better father than I am, I wouldn't rush out into the yard with a belt or a ruler or a hickory limb and grab David Lynn or Danny and just walk out and grab a hold of them and start beating them and then walk off with no explanation. I'd go out and get a hold of those kids and I'd tell them, you did this or you failed to do this, and that's what the whipping's for. There have been some times in my life when I've been under the chastising hand of God and I knew what it was about. I was up in the state of North Carolina about 8 years ago, and they asked me to come over and preach in the home of a man who at 23 years of age, he was at that time about 46, who at 23 years of age was afflicted with crippling arthritis, and he was drawn up worse than I am right now. And they asked me to come there and preach at his home, and that brother's in such bad condition that I get a Christmas card from him every year, and it'll read about like this. Dear Brother Piles, I sincerely hope that God is blessing you in your efforts to preach, and I hope you can come and preach in my home again. I will quit writing now because it's taken me 1.5 hours to write this. I've got several of those Christmas cards. Man lays there on the flat of his back, been there 23 years in that bed. Lay there on the flat of his back and take him 1.5 hours to write what I've just read off to you. All right? Right after he suffered that crippling stroke, his wife put up with it 1.5 years, waiting on him hand and foot, and out the door she went. Took off. And his sister waited on him for years, and it's just about broken her down. And the first time I ever preached at that brother's bedside, he called me over, and he says, I want to ask you a question that I've never asked another man in my life. He said, I have laid here on my back for 23 years praying and searching and seeking, searching my life and asking God, what is it that I ever did or failed to do that caused this? He said, I can't find a thing. He said, I want to know, am I being punished for something I did or failed to do? I told him, I said, if God was chastised, you'd know what it's for. Because God's a better father than I am, and I don't go out in the yard and grab my children and start beating on them unless I tell them what it's all about. All right? I firmly realize tonight that there is suffering and there's chastisement that comes upon God's children for their own good. All right? I go over here into the 12th chapter of Hebrews, and I want to notice a very clear lesson starting at verse 6. I believe I set up at Cool Springs about 2 weeks ago, but I wish to affirm it from this pulpit tonight. There are two extremes that parents can go to. Well, on one extreme, you can find parents that lavish their children with love and affection and understanding. I mean, these little mamas that'll carry their daughters their breakfast in bed, and they'll let their kids stay out all hours of the night, and they're just so understanding of everything that the children do. They wouldn't dare say a hard word, wouldn't dare swat them, wouldn't dare paddle them, wouldn't do one thing. It's just love, 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 love. And that extreme usually will produce a pampered, petted, spoiled daughter or a ruined son who are nothing but big, overgrown babies. On the other hand, let's get on the other extreme. I've been in old Baptist homes that were like a military camp, where no affection was ever shown. I mean, where children were just clamped down like that, the clamps were put on them all the way around. And I'll tell you one thing quite frankly. If you clamp your children down on every point, clamp them down on every point, one of these days when those clamps are taken off, brother, they're going to head out in all directions at once. I talked to Primitive Baptist parents from one coast to the other who've been successful in rearing fine families of children. Some of these people I've talked to are very wealthy. Some of them are poor. Some of them are well-educated. Some of them have very little education. And I've sat in the wee hours of the night talking to good old mamas and daddies. Some of them reared two. Some of them reared 8, 9, 10. One old brother up in West Tennessee reared 12 fine children. And I've asked them what they did. And what it all boils down to is this, is that most of these people, in fact, all of them tell me that they had areas in which they had laws and rules that their children didn't break. But they had other areas where they had the responsibility and choice of their own good self. There's an old brother I know in West Tennessee that told me he reared so many children that he had to put a bunch of chairs in the back of a pickup and put those kids back there in chairs in order to be able to get them all at church. I mean, they had a house full of children. And he told his children, he said, "You're going to church come meeting day." There's no question about it. But after church, after they went to church, he says, "You can go out and play ball, be with your friends, do what you want to." All right, you see what he was doing? On the other hand, I could tell you of some old Baptist preachers that made their children go to church, and then after church, they had to sit over here in some widow or some old brother's parlor all afternoon, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday, and I could tell you about some of those kids today that despise the old Baptist church. You see what I'm talking about? Here's some over here. Here's some parents that have some laws that you don't break. But over here, you've got the exercise and choice of your own good sense and some other things, all right? What you're seeing here is a relationship with a child that's both negative and positive. When God made this universe out of Adam, he gave that Adam a negative and a positive particle. He made everything in this universe, male and female, heat and light, expansion and contraction. The universe is a balance of opposites. The Chinese call it the yin-yang. All right, however you want to look at it tonight, I'll prove to you tonight that God's dealings with his children are a balance of negative and positive. All right, let's go here to Hebrews chapter 12, look at verse 6. It says, "Every son whom the Lord loveth," positive, "he chasteneth," negative, "and he scourgeth," negative, "every son whom he receiveth," positive. God's love is a mixture of affection and correction. It's a mixture of gentle, kind love and rigid discipline. It's a mixture of the two. In Revelation chapter 3, verse 19, he tells that church, he says, "As many as I love positively, I rebuke and chasten negatively. Be zealous therefore and repent." It's a combination of the two. All right? I firmly admit tonight that there is chastisement that's taught in the Bible that God sends. But my friend, if you begin to suffer something, if you begin to undergo chastisement, and you have no earthly idea what it's all about and what it's for, what purpose does it serve? All right? Now then, whenever I began to search the scriptures, and I began to read about the sufferings of some of God's people, may I say this tonight and just lay a secure foundation, that whatever it is that we suffer in this life, we deserve it. God's not unjust regardless of how much you suffer. Because in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, we read that it was man that brought death into this world. Man brought death into this world. Romans chapter 6, verse 23 tells us that the wages of sin is death, and man is the cause of death and disease and suffering being in this world. Man brought it here. All right, next. May I say to every little child of God in this building tonight, if your future is to spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair or an iron lung or wearing a pacemaker or to be over here under a breathing machine, or if your future is to suffer crippling arthritis for 20 or 30 years, what is a few years of suffering compared to an eternity in hell? And eternity in hell is what you deserve. That's what you deserve. Because the Bible teaches us that the wages of sin is death. That's what you deserve. All right? God forbid that it should happen to me, but I might be afflicted tonight and have to spend 30 or 40 more years suffering. But I'll tell you one thing, that all the sufferings that God's people ever know are right here in this life. And what 60 or 70 or 80 years of suffering in this life, maybe spent in an iron lung, an intensive care ward, a wheelchair, what 60 or 70 or 80 years in this life spent in a mental asylum compared to an eternity in hell? All right? First principle. Regardless of how much we suffer in this life, God's still just. All right? But I want to notice some of the purposes of the suffering and some of the things that are accomplished by the sufferings of God's people. I go over into one of the most outstanding books found anywhere in the Bible, the book of Job. I read over there of a very outstanding man named Job, and Satan appears in the presence of God and raises this question. He's always the question box. The first thing that that book records the old devil is saying in Genesis chapter 3 verse 1 is in the negative. He's raising a question. Yea, hath God said? And when he's got the Lord Jesus Christ up there on that mount of temptation in Luke chapter 4, he says, if thou be the Son of God. He's the question box. And now he's popping the question, and he'll question you tonight. He'll cause you to question if that's God's book or just a collection of Jewish myths and fairy tales. He'll cause you to question the accuracy and the authenticity of the 1611 Bible. He'll cause you to question if this is the right church. He'll cause you to question your pastor. He'll cause you to question your wife, your husband, your children, the sincerity of your friends, and he'll cause you to question yourself. And he'll cause you to question your hope and your salvation. He's the question box. Alright? The old question box says, does Job fear God for naught? And what's the accusation? He says, you've hedged him about. Says you've provided him with all of this. You've been so good to him. You have so wonderfully blessed him. But he says, if you'll take all that away, says he will curse you to your face. That's what the devil says. All right. We begin to read about the afflictions of Job. I read over there, of the loss of Joseph's goods. We read of the afflictions and the sufferings of his children. We read of death in his family. We read over there where Job was reduced to that place that he is covered with boils from head to toe, and he takes a potsherd, which was an old broken pot. He breaks an old clay pot and begins to scrape it. For God was falling. He says, naked came I into this world, and naked I leave it. He said, the Lord hath gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I want you to notice some of the things that Job is accomplishing here in his suffering. First of all, my friends, Job is slapping the devil right in the face, and he's making a liar out of the devil. Because the devil says, take all that away, and says he'll curse you in his face. And he's making a liar out of the devil by cheerfully enduring what was sent upon him. And not only that, in those chapters of the book of Job, here was the suffering of one man. But the suffering of that one man has served as a source of strength and inspiration to thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of God's children who suffered in the centuries past. Have you ever wondered about how many crippled people, how many cancer victims, how many boys over here that were shot all to pieces during the war, how many people that laid up in hospitals and laid back in old homes in the day when we didn't have hospitals, people that were maybe off in the back room of some of these old hot Georgia houses without any fans or anything else laying in there dying? Have you ever wondered how many of those people scanned the pages of the book of Job and looked at those things and found comfort and solace in it? My friend Job, in holding up under those afflictions, Job has become a legend, teaching God's people patience. Patience in suffering, patience in tribulation. The oldest deacon of our home church, for a number of years, has been afflicted with skin cancer. And that poor old brother out there, they've taken this ear over here completely off. And they've taken away about 3/4 of that ear over there. They take the old man in the hospital, they start quacking on those things. I go in to see him. I say, Brother Weaver, they're going to let you go home? He said, yeah. I said, reckon how long you'll get to stay? He said, all right, and grow some more of these old things. But you know what he said? I went in there one time, they had him all bandaged up, they'd been cutting on the old fella, and if you could see him tonight, you'd say, that's the ugliest man I ever looked at. Well, he's not ugly to me. I'll tell you one thing, I know what's on the inside. Yeah. All right. Now, that old brother comes to church in the midst of the snow and ice. It doesn't get too hot or too cold or too rough. And he's way up in his 80s. He puts our younger members to shame. I went in to see that old man one time. His head was all bandaged up. And he says, you know, Brother Piles, he said, I've been laying here this afternoon feeling sorry for myself. Because he said, I'm just as ugly as homemade sin. So they've cut my face all to pieces. And said, I hate to even go to church and let the church members look at me. And said, they've been cutting on me since 1929. And he said, I've been feeling sorry for myself because I didn't have any ear over here. And this one's nearly gone. But he said, I'll tell you one thing. He said, there's a lot of people got two pretty ears that can't hear a lick. And said, I haven't got any ears, and I still hear you preach real good. He said, I've been laying here reading about Job. And he said, I got these old boils and skin cancers on my face. And he said, they cut me up till I'm too ugly to look at. But said, Job had them from head to toe. And he said, I don't feel sorry for Ben Weaver at all. He said, I feel sorry for Job. All right, my friend, how many people in this world have received strength by reading of the sufferings of Job? Yeah, here was the sufferings of one man, but look what a source of strength and consolation it has been to thousands of others. And I tell you quite frankly tonight, that I can tell you about people in the Old Baptist Church that have borne their afflictions and they have borne their problems. They have borne those things cheerfully and they have been a strength to others when other people were called upon to bear those things. All right? It's very common. And any minister here tonight knows what I'm talking about. It's been my experience many times to have people come and talk to me about some kind of problem they had, and they approach me like nobody else from the foundation of the world has ever been through what they're going through. I had a preacher friend out at home that in a 6 weeks period of time, three of his children got in some of the worst kind of trouble I could describe. In 6 weeks' time, three of them. All right? I can tell you tonight, people have gone through sufferings and trials and afflictions that have talked to me like nobody understands. Nobody's ever been here before. You know what that book says, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13? It says, there hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. And the worst thing that ever happens to you in this life, it's already happened to other people beforehand. And if you'll look around you a little bit, you're going to find somebody else that's already borne that cross. A number of years ago, about 14 years ago, there's a little afflicted boy born into my family. And I'll have to tell you quite frankly, I've gone through life for years and barely noticed those kids. Oh, there's a lot of you people here tonight say, oh, I've got all the sympathy and the compassion in this world for afflicted children. Well, I thought I did for years. You know, back when I was a boy, one of my very favorite preachers was old Uncle Bob Wilson. I went down to Arkansas one time to hear Uncle Bob preach, stayed with him about 2 weeks. And you know, all I thought was on Uncle Bob's mind back in those days was just preaching the gospel. We just having a good time hearing him preach at night and fishing by day and visiting people's homes and hearing him answer Bible questions, going up and down the road like there was a care in the world. And when we got back to his home in Tyler, Texas, there's a boy there who was probably about 21 or 22 years of age. And he had whiskers on his face about a half inch long. And his daddy walked up to him and hugged that little afflicted boy, little Johnny Wilson. And he cried and he told him how much he loved him. And he went in there and he got a razor and some soap. And he began to shave little Johnny Wilson and told him how much he loved him. The woman that was taking care of him was Brother Wilson's wife, but she wasn't Johnny's mother. Oh, she loved the boy, but she probably wasn't able to take care of him, probably wasn't able to handle him. All right, I'll tell you something quite frankly. About 14 years ago, a little boy like that was born into my family. And I remembered things about old Uncle Bob Wilson. And I can tell you tonight from experience that during those times when that old gentleman was off away with me preaching the gospel and talking about the things of God, and supposedly having a good time, that little boy was in the back of his mind all the time. And my little boy's 14, and I've had to get out the razor and the soap a few times, and I never get out the razor and the soap the while I don't think about Uncle Bob. Because back there a number of years ago, as a great big old strapping, overgrown 17-year-old boy without a care in this world, I looked at that, and I thought, that sure is pitiful. I sure feel sorry. But I didn't. I didn't feel sorry till I was put over in Uncle Bob's shoes. All right, here's the next thing I want to point out to you tonight that's accomplished by the afflictions of the people of God. There are a lot of you dear people here tonight that might come up to me. People do it all the time. They say, Brother Piles, pray for me. I'm going to the hospital tomorrow. They're going to cut me wide open, put a pacemaker in here. They're going to go in here and do open heart surgery. Or somebody will come up and say, this is the third time this year I've gone into surgery. They've cut me this way and that way and this way. And I want you to pray for me because I'm going in there to suffer. And I'm scared. And I want you to pray for me. I have people come up to me all the time. And they'll tell me how many years they've had arthritis. And how many years they've suffered with this. Have they suffered with that? And I'll tell you one thing. I try to sympathize with them. I do. And I try to pray for them. But really, when you get down to brass tacks, I don't know what you're talking about. Because I've been healthy all of my life. I may go to a hospital before this week's out. But up until this present hour, my back's never hit a hospital sheet. I've never been in a hospital a night of my life. I don't spend $5 or $10 a year at doctors. I'm afflicted with chronic sinus trouble, just my way of preaching. If I go to a doctor and take tests, I'm probably allergic to about 15 or maybe 25 things. I don't know what they are, and I don't care to find out. Because I've got some little ideas about that stuff myself. All right? I never have been real sick, except, you know, the voice trouble that goes with preaching, sinus trouble, allergies, and all that. But other than that, I've never been sick. Never really been sick in my life. A few colds, maybe the flu a few times and all of that.
You know, when you go to talking about, I'm going under that surgical knife for the second or third time this year, while I go into those hospitals out in Graham, Texas, and there's some good person there that's been cut on time and time again, and they've got that fear that they'll never come out of that place alive. I hold their hand, and I offer prayer for them, but I don't really know what it's all about. There's some of you good people here tonight that probably could be more comfort and more care to those people than I could. But on the other hand, I'm going to tell you some places where I'm eminently and highly qualified. I was in a place not too long ago. There's a young couple in that church had brought a mongoloid baby into the world. And they were just about to come apart mentally and emotionally. And their pastor told them, they said, there's a man coming here to preach a meeting for us. He says he can help you more than anybody else I know of in this world. All right? There's some ways tonight I'm eminently qualified. I know what it is to be the parent of an afflicted child. When I was preaching up here at Cool Springs about 3 years ago, they sent out a request for me to come up and preach to the afflicted children up there at that school at Jeffersonville. Well, I went up there one morning about 8:30. They gathered about 30 or 35 of those kids in there to hear me preach. Somebody says, how can you preach to retarded children? It's not hard for me. Not hard at all. I know their language. I know how they think. I've got 14 years experience dealing with them. I know something about that. All right? What I want to point out to you tonight is that the trials and the afflictions and the things that you have suffered in life, they can help you to help other people to bear their burden. This preacher friend I was telling you about that came out to my home last year, three of his children had gotten in bad, bad trouble. I mean bad trouble. In 6 weeks' time. I've never had that type of trouble in my family. God forbid. I hope I never do. But there's a minister sitting right there on the couch that his teenage daughter had gone right down that same road. And he thought it was the greatest tragedy that ever happened to him in life. But that brother had the privilege of reaching down and picking up another poorer soldier of the cross that is in that same fix. All right? And I'm telling you tonight that some of the afflictions and some of the battles and some of the trials that you're going through that you despise and that maybe you'd say God's unjust over, one of these days those things may give you the experience and the qualification to lift somebody out of a mud hole. And then you'll begin to glory in your tribulation. You'll begin to glory in it. You begin to glory in those afflictions, and you'll understand what James says when he writes over here in chapter 1, verse 2. He says, my brethren, account it all joy when you fall into divers temptations. And you'll know what Peter's talking about when he wrote over there in his second epistle, chapter 1, verse 6. And he says, though now, he says, that now you're going through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, though it be more precious than that of gold that perishes. He said there's a purpose in it. All right? My friends, our sufferings and our trials and afflictions help us to help other people bear their burdens in this life. And they make us more efficient and more dedicated soldiers of the cross. And another thing that your trials and burdens and afflictions do is that they awaken you to your spiritual responsibilities. I said one night since I've been here trying to preach that if you took all the debt and you took all the suffering and all the affliction and all the heartache and all the corruption out of this world, you couldn't get a busload interested in going to glory. You couldn't. Well, you couldn't, because the natural man is of this earth earthy, and he likes the things that's here on terra firma. And my friends, there's a tendency among all of us that when things are going well for us, physically, spiritually, financially, when things are going well for us, that we have a way of forgetting God. I read the scriptures where the children of Israel wax fat, how that over here in the land of blessing they very soon forgot the ways of God. David said that was his own experience. Look at Psalms 119, verse 67, 119:67. He says, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But he says, but now I have kept thy word. Oh, I'll tell you quite frankly. I mean, you can get out of bed feeling real well, go down here to your job, draw a good paycheck. Everything's going well. Plenty of rain on the crops. Everything's going well up at the church. And the first thing you know, you put in a whole day and haven't thought too much about the Lord. And over there at the close of the day, you pray that little prayer, Lord, now I lay me down to sleep. Pray the Lord my soul to keep and watch and die before awake. Pray the Lord my soul to take. Amen. That's the way it goes. But I'll tell you one thing. You can start having old pains in the chest. You can go down here to the doctor and get a bad report. your son and daughter-in-law can start having trouble in their marriage. One of your little grandchildren can come up blind, or one of your children can come up mentally afflicted. You can get some trouble over here at the house of God. You can get some spiritual trouble. You can start carrying a financial burden. And brother, you'll find yourself waking up 10 o'clock at night saying a little prayer to God. Long about 1 o'clock in the morning, your eyes pop open, and you start praying to God. Long about 4:30 a.m., you start praying to God. And long about daylight, the first thing that pops in your mind, when you wake up, you start carrying that burden to God. That's what David said happened to him in Psalm 63, verse 6. He said, Lord, he'll think on his, on your name when I meditate upon thee on my bed in the night watches. Well, I can see David there all night long, meditating on the name of God. And you'll find yourself when you're in deep trouble. I mean, when there's trouble in your family, trouble in your life, trouble with your health, when you're over here in some kind of spiritual trouble, you'll find yourself down there at that grocery store running to the back and kneeling down by a bunch of orange crates and praying to God. And the farmer will find himself out here stopping that tractor right in the middle of a row and taking his hat off and bowing to God. You'll find yourself out here on the top of a rusty combine making a turn, and you'll stop there and pour your heart out to God, or pull your car over to the side of the road when you're in trouble. That's what David said. I wish I had it tonight, a little poem that appeared in about issue before last of Brother Bradley's paper. It told about a little poem about yea big, told about how life would be if nothing ever went wrong. You know, things always went smooth. I thought enough of it. I cut it out and put it in my Bible, and I'm not too hung up on poetry, but I sure like that one. David says, before I was afflicted, he said, I went astray, but now have I kept thy word. I'll tell you one thing. I didn't understand a number of years ago when my child was small, born into this world mentally afflicted, but there's an old soldier of the cross named Elder C.E. Smith. Preached for another denomination of people 40 years and spent 9 years with our people. The old Brother Smith used to come to my home, and he'd stay 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And he'd sit there and rock my little afflicted baby Danny, and I'd hear him muttering and mumbling, a God-sent trial, a God-sent trial. I didn't know what that old brother was talking about 10 or 12 years ago. I had no idea. But I found out a little more about him as we got better acquainted. He had a baby buried in Holdenville, Oklahoma. He had another one buried out there on the Western Plains. That old man had known some trials and afflictions. He had buried one wife and about 2 babies. He knew what afflictions and trials did for you. I'll tell you one thing. I poured out my heart to God a lot more over that little afflicted boy than I have over those 2 healthy kids. Sometimes it takes troubles and afflictions to bring us near to the cross. That's where we need to be. As a preacher friend of mine in another section of the country, people started telling some of the most filthy, abominable stuff on him that could possibly be told on a man. And he talked to me one night at midnight. He's depressed and defeated and discouraged. He said, Brother Piles, I've heard you preach in our country that the way you pray to God is that, Lord, I can handle my enemies, protect me from my friends. And by the way, that's a pretty good way to pray. And he said, I didn't understand that, but he says it's my friends that have turned on me. He says it's the best friends I've got in the world that are telling these things on me. He said, my friends have turned on me. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing, it'll teach you. It'll teach you to depend on your Lord instead of your friends. One thing it'll do. All right, now then. My dear friends, may I close tonight by sharing with you something that I have imparted and tried to give to people who were in suffering and affliction all over the United States of America. It's helped lots of folks. It may not help you. Some of you young people here tonight that have never been in any trouble, you may not have gotten one thing out of the preaching I've done tonight. And I hope you never need what I've said tonight. But you probably will. And if you try to serve God, I'm pretty sure you will. But a number of years ago, when my wife and I were nearly crushed under the weight and burden of having an afflicted child in our family, there's a man named Dr. Hugo Clint, who was head of the Diagnostic Evaluation Center for the state of Texas, passed this on to me. He said, Elder Piles, he said, when tragedy comes into a human life, such as the birth of an afflicted child or a child's born dead, or something bad goes wrong in a family, he said, people usually go through 4 steps. His step number one, he says, they blame God. All right, that's what this man did in the 73rd Psalm. He didn't understand. All right, they blame God. All right. A little afflicted child born into your family. And maybe you see, somebody down here conceived one out of wedlock that's a genius. At about the same time, my wife and I were trying to serve God in our little imperfect way. I was trying to serve churches. We're trying to live for the Lord best we knew how. There's some folks I knew that conceived a child out of wedlock that today is the same age as my son, that's a genius. That's a pretty bitter pill for me to swallow for a few years. And step one, you can blame God. And don't you tell me, oh, that'll never happen to me. Listen, I know people that have abandoned the church. I can tell you a young man tonight that's brought up in a good old Baptist home, had some afflictions come to him, and he said there's not a God, and abandoned the church and tried to give it all up. I think God's dealing with him. I really do. But he said, in step one, they blame God. In step two, they blame themselves. It's something I've done that's caused this, or something I failed to do. All right? Step three, they blame other people. We had some people out at home 6 years ago, had a little girl that was run over and killed by a truck driver. They went through all four of these steps. They were religious people, church-going people. They went through a period of time of blaming God, that there's no way God could be just and let that happen. After they got over that, they started blaming themselves. They weren't going to church enough. They weren't giving enough. They weren't spiritual enough. They went through step three. They started blaming that truck driver. And step four, you start seeking for a solution and learning to live with it and bearing it gracefully. That's step four. All right. Over here in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, the Apostle Paul begins to name the gifts that are put in the church. Down there in the closing verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, he names the gifts that are put in the church, and he says among those gifts are gifts of healings, plural. More than one type of healing in the church. There's physical healing. God grants physical healing. He can. He still does. Not because somebody said some mumbo-jumbo, gave you a drop of holy oil, gave you a prayer cloth, but because God saw fit to do so. All right? There's physical healing, but there's other types of healing. My friend, may I say this along that line? I'll move on. I do not believe in divine healers, but I believe in divine healing. There's a world of difference. I believe in divine healing because God's as able as he ever was. I don't believe in divine healers. I don't believe in any man on earth got any more power to pray and cast aside disease than any other. But I believe in divine healing. God's as able as he ever was. But on the other hand, here's another type of healing. You're undergoing a bodily affliction. Maybe you've been told that you've got a terminal disease that's going to take your life. You're crushed under that thing and you cannot bear it. You say, there's no way I can bear it. And you pray over that matter and your friends pray over it and the church members pray over it. And the next thing you know, you're bearing that cheerfully. You're submissive to it, bearing it cheerfully. Did you know there's a healing taking place? And I'll tell you this tonight, there's been some healing take place in my family. Here's something I've told you quite a bit about tonight, that for a while I was bitter over it. A while I was confused over it. But tonight I'm submissive to the will of God. All right? Let's go back to that text, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but also will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. All right? Let's notice the Apostle Paul. Over here in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, the Apostle Paul says that I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago, such a one caught up into the third heaven. He says, whether in the body, I cannot tell. He didn't say he didn't know. He said he couldn't tell. There's a difference. He said, I can't tell. He didn't say I don't know. He said, I cannot tell. Whether in the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. Or out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. He said, I was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which it was unlawful to utter. It is unlawful to tell. Did you catch the difference? He didn't say he didn't know it. He said he couldn't tell it because it's unlawful to utter it. All right? And because of all this knowledge that God had given Paul, he said, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should become exalted above measure by these revelations. He says, there's given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me. Now, wait a minute. All right. You say, well, what was that thorn in the flesh? Well, if I could tell you tonight all the different theories and conjectures and ideas that have been written about that thorn in the flesh, it'd probably take up enough paper and enough ink to stock a small office supply. All right? I've read about a half dozen different ideas on what that thorn in the flesh is, and I don't know, and neither does anybody else. Isn't that ugly? It's the truth. It's the ugly truth. All right? I've heard men say, well, Paul, was his thorn in the flesh was blindness, because he writes over here in the Galatian letter, he says, you see how large a letter I have written to you of my own hand. The new versions of the Bible say this. You see what big letters I make as I am writing to you, because I'm nearly stone blind. Well, Paul's not saying there I'm writing all over the page because I'm nearly stone blind. He's saying here that I started out to write you a shorter letter, and you see it's a long letter. That's the way it usually works out. All right. Some folks say, well, Paul suffered a speech defect. Because, you know, they said about Paul that his letters are weighty and powerful, but his speech is contemptible. He has speech defect. You know what they're telling old Paul? He's a better writer than he is a preacher. And I'll guarantee you, if any old Baptist preacher starts writing for these papers, it won't be long somebody say, he's a better writer than he is a preacher. Well, that's what's said about Paul. Better writer than he is a preacher. That's what's said about Sylvester Hassel. That's what they say about just about all of them. I imagine when Brother Bowles had a paper, they probably said it about him. They said it about Brother Tolley. They tell it on Afton Richards. Well, if I keep on writing for the papers, they'll probably tell it on me. All right, now notice. All right, watch this. They say, well, Paul had a speech defect. Some of them say, well, he had eye trouble. Well, I'll tell you tonight, as far as his thorn in the flesh, I've got a little idea of my own. But it's just pocket change. But I've got an idea. But I wouldn't push it off on anybody. Because it's probably not any better than yours. All right? What that thorn in the flesh is not clear. And you know what that teaches me? That teaches me it's not important. Because if it had been important, God would have told me and made it clear what it was, if it had been important. But there's one thing that's crystal clear about that thorn in the flesh. It's crystal clear what it was given for. And the reason it's given is important. What it was is not important. And the reason it was given is that God had given that man so much knowledge that he gave to him this to buffet him, lest he should become exalted above measure. And so the lesson to you, me, Brother Lord, anybody in this building or anywhere else is, that we better not get exalted. That's why it was given. All right, but notice. It was something that Paul ordinarily wouldn't want it to have borne. And he prayed to God three times to have it taken away. But the Lord said to him, he said, my grace is sufficient for thee. My strength made perfect in weakness. Instead of taking that away, he said, you're going to bear it. You're going to bear it. Instead of taking it away, he gave Paul the grace to bear it. And there may be some of you people here tonight that may be afflicted in one way or the other. And it may please God tonight that you bear that affliction. And him give you the grace to bear it. Remember those four things tonight. Some of you good folks may need them someday. There's a family I know of, outstanding Primitive Baptist family, that their boy apparently for no reason at all took his own life. And I wrote that family those four steps. And they told me later, they said, we got bags and bags and bags of mail when that happened in our family. The father told me. But he said, I don't remember any of them except the letter you wrote. Because they went through that 1, 2, 3, 4. They blamed God. They blamed themselves. They blamed others or blamed circumstances. And finally, they began to seek for a solution. All right. I close tonight by pointing this out about suffering. Nearly every time in the New Testament you find the word sufferings, you're not going to look very far and you find the word glory. Luke chapter 24, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to have entered into his glory? Hebrews chapter 2 verse 9, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 11 says those Old Testament prophets were searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ that was in them did signify when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. All right, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 1. Peter says, the elders among you I exhort, who am also an elder, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. You notice how glory follows suffering? Glory follows suffering? All right. In the eighth chapter of the book of Romans, verse 17, it says that we are heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer together with him, or that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. Notice the next verse. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16. The Apostle Paul says, for our light affliction, sufferings and affliction, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things which are not seen. He says the things which are seen are temporal, earthly, but the things which are not seen are eternal. I want to close with a couple of thoughts on that text right there. He says, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment. You know what that calls the afflictions and troubles of life? It calls them light afflictions. All right? You try it sometime. You go down here in a hospital ward, you hear somebody been slashed wide open, been sewed up, they're laying there in pain, and you walk in there and say, how are you coming along in that light affliction? The man will give you a hard look. So you get over this bed where I am a minute and a half, you'll think light affliction. I saw a picture about a year and a half ago, when that plane crashed up there in New York, killed 103 people, Eastern Airlines plane. They showed a great big old boy who was an athlete about 23 years of age. They had him there in the burn ward. His body was covered with burns. They had him packed in Vaseline petroleum jelly. They had his fingers spread apart like so. There he was. They told how many days, maybe weeks, he'd be there in that condition. I mean, packed in Vaseline, just burned all to pieces. All right? Suppose you walked in on that boy, and you said, hey, how you coming along in that light affliction? You say, light affliction, my foot, you get over here about 45 seconds. All right? The afflictions of life aren't light. But Paul says they're light only when. He says they're light while we're looking at something else. All right? Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory while we look. That's what makes it life. The afflictions of life aren't life. Cancer is not life. Emphysema, Raynaud's disease, burns, those things aren't life. He says our light affliction is light while we look, not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, they're earthly, but the things which are not seen are eternal. You know what he's saying there? He's saying in the hardest afflictions of your life, the intensive care ward, the burn center, while you're wearing that pacemaker, while you're in that wheelchair, while you're on that set of crutches, that the hardest afflictions of life become light to you if you keep your eye on the unseen spiritual things. As long as your eye's on that, this is light. But if you ever get your eye off of that, this can get unbearable. Remember those children of Israel over in the 15th chapter of Exodus? They travel in the wilderness 3 days, and they don't have any water, and they're thirsty, and they come to a pool of water, and it's called Marah, meaning bitter. You know the way they drank that water? God points out to Moses a tree, and Moses cast that tree in the water, and the waters became sweet. That tree, as far as I'm concerned, is the cross. And I tell you tonight, that mental affliction and death and emphysema and cancer and strokes and the things I've been talking about tonight and car wrecks and plane crashes and the untimely deaths of your children and the loss of your husband and loved ones and wars and atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs and earthquakes and tidal waves and the troubles of this life, they're only light as long as you've got your eye on those eternal things. And bear in mind that the sufferings of this present life are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Thank you for your good attention. God bless you.